This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Solar World. We're about to speak to Ron Resch, who's the president of the Solar Energy Industries Association. He's based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Utopia Media's Solar World.
Thank you, Mark.
We're here to talk about the SDG&E, San Diego Gas and Electric project that it just signed up for with Sterling Energy Systems of Phoenix. Could you give us the gist of what that deal is about, what it covers, what it's going to mean?
Absolutely. What we're talking about here is a concentrating solar power project that for the first stage is a 300-megawatt solar power plant. It'll consist of 12,000 what are called Stirling solar dish engines, and these are a modular type of concentrating solar power where they use mirrors to concentrate the sun onto a Stirling engine. A Stirling engine is an external combustion engine, and it generates electricity right at that site. These are then all combined and put into the grid. One of the more interesting things about the Stirling dish engine technology is that it uses absolutely no water. So unlike natural gas, unlike nuclear, there is absolutely no water used to generate electricity. So in the Southwest, this becomes a critical element, not only in providing a renewable energy resource, but providing one that uses none of the natural resources that may be in limited quantity in the Southwest as well. So the basic project overview is that it's a 20-year power purchase agreement between SDG&E and Sterling Energy Systems for 300 megawatts. And then SDG&E has options on two future phases that could add up an additional 600 megawatts of solar energy capacity to SDG&E's resource mix.
Okay, now Sterling Energy Systems recently signed a similar agreement with Southern California Edison. How does this deal compare with that? Who's on first now for the building the world's largest solar electricity generating system? And what's the implication of these two big deals following so closely together?
The Southern California Edison project is a 500-megawatt project, similar in structure. It's a 20-year power purchase agreement that will consist of about 20,000 Stirling dish engines. And then they have an agreement, or I should say an option for purchasing another 350 megawatts. So all told, you're talking about 1,750 megawatts, so 1.75 gigawatts of electricity coming from the sun in Southern California. I wouldn't say it's a competition between the utilities. I'd say it's a huge victory for all of the ratepayers, all of those who breathe the air in California and states downwind, and for the solar energy industry in general.
How about the people who are going to? How about as a benefit for the people who are going to be constructing these engines?
Absolutely, there will be a tremendous number of jobs, both in the manufacturing of the equipment, in the steel that will be used to build these engines, the engines themselves, the construction on site. You're talking about manufacturing and an increase in jobs in probably four or five different states around the United States. So I don't necessarily have any good numbers, but you know, one rule of thumb that we've found pretty consistent across the industry is that for each megawatt of solar installed, you create somewhere between 30 and 35 new jobs. So you're talking about, between these two projects, 1,750 megawatts. So you're talking about 50,000 new jobs created in the solar industry.
Okay. Say a little bit about the availability of the fuel that's going to be used to fuel these plants in terms of its boycottability, its location in unstable parts of the world, and its non-renewable or renewable nature.
And the price volatility.
And the price volatility of the solar energy.
Right. Well, we lobbied hard in the energy bill to have them pass 365 days of pure sunshine in the United States, but they wouldn't go for it.
Okay, so we have to do it on a state-by-state basis, I suppose, now.
Well, the beautiful thing is, in the United States, we have the greatest solar resources of any developed country in the world, period. And when you look into the Southwest, New Mexico, Arizona, California, Nevada, and Utah, that's really the perfect location for this this technology. It is concentrating sunshine onto kind of a central point which generates heat and then runs an engine. So this technology provides firm, peak power. And this is important for people to understand, because peak power is the most expensive power. This is the power that is consumed between the hours of about 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. It's when everybody goes into work, turns on the computers, turns on the lights, turns on the air conditioners. The cash market, or the spot market, for peak power can be in the 30s, 40s, and 50 cents per kilowatt hour.
This is in fact where Enron made its ill-gotten gains, isn't it?
In large part, is tweaking that market. That's
right.
Exactly right. Is to hold back. They held back production in order to push that marketplace up.
Right.
And in this case, what you're doing is you're providing 20 years of firm peak power electricity at a very reasonable rate. So not only does it benefit the utility and those who breathe the air, but also the ratepayers themselves.
Okay. Also on the financial side, the availability and therefore the cost of fossil fuels is only going to get worse, whereas we've got about 3 billion years of steady sunlight to depend on.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's no doubt that the direction that energy prices are going is up. And so to be able to lock in a technology at today's electricity prices is a good bet, regardless of what you see, especially one that doesn't use any water. And when you step back and say, okay, what's happening with the fossil fuel industry? Sure, we've seen oil and natural gas go up, but the Energy Information Administration yesterday came out with a report that shows that throughout the United States, the cost to heat your home with natural gas this year will be 70% higher than it was last year. 70%. So you translate
that's an even bigger increase than gasoline prices have undergone.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, it's going to be a huge hit to our economy. So the more people can turn towards solar as a technology, not only for providing electricity, but also for heat and hot water, the better off they're going to be.
Okay, now let's talk about, it's more the physics, I think, but also the regulatory and administrative questions. What's the possibility, what's the state of the national grid to allow the generation of solar power in the Southwest and to export it to the Northeast, essentially, into other areas?
It's right now, with our current technology, it's an impossibility.
Okay.
There's too much of a line loss that occurs between large distances. So you want to site your generating facilities as close to your use as possible.
Okay, well, two questions that follow from that. Does that mean that the Southwest is going to be materially advantaged in relation to the Northeast and and other areas of the country in coming years as fossil fuel prices continue to rise?
Well,
and the economies, because it's hard to export this for long distances, energy prices will fall in the Southwest and rise in other areas and so on and so on?
No, I don't think that'll be the case.
Okay.
I think what you'll see is different technologies have different applications regionally. So
okay.
In the Southwest, you'll see concentrating solar power
because
it works literally in those areas that have the best solar resources.
Right.
But the difference in solar radiation between Los Angeles and Portland, Maine is only 20%.
Okay.
Which means you only need to install about 20% more panels on your home in Portland, Maine, to get the same amount of electricity output as you would in Los Angeles.
Photovoltaic panels.
That's a photovoltaic. That's exactly right. So you'll see concentrating solar power in California, New Mexico, and Arizona, but you'll see photovoltaics used in much greater numbers really throughout the entire country.
Okay, now say something about the applicability of photovoltaics for individual businesses or homes, as opposed to the heat concentrating engines that are going to be used here in the SDG&E case.
Well, in this case, we're talking about building a large 300 megawatt power plant.
Right, in one place.
And this is a centralized power plant, very similar to a coal-fired power plant, a nuclear power plant, in the sense that it is centralized and it goes out onto the grid over long lines, and then has to go through step down through transmission and distribution, and you pay taxes, and it gets to your home, and boom, you've got all your electricity showing up when you're trying to switch.
Right.
With respect to photovoltaics, they're what's called distributed generation. Distributed generation means that it starts to generate electricity at the point of use. So it sits on your rooftop, doesn't have to go through any of the lines. It's consumed where it is generated, and the beautiful thing in that capacity is if the grid goes down or if portions of the grid go down, you are still generating and using electricity on site. So it's got a different type of application. There, I don't think they're going to compete against each other. Rather, they both serve an important purpose.
So there's no real practical way to build these Stirling engines in small enough sizes and deploy them in neighborhoods or on rooftops or in backyards.
Well, I think in the long run, that's what you'll see. I think as SES scales up their manufacturing,
right,
and costs come down,
right,
you know, what you have basically is, you know, is a 30-foot dish that,
right,
could sit on top of a Home Depot or a McDonald's or,
right,
a neighborhood
or in a lot of the parking,
or a hospital or any place,
right, or all the parking lots that are here and all around.
Absolutely. No, you're
and could in fact be used to charge up next generation hybrid electric vehicles.
I think that's where we'd all like to head.
As they sit in the parking lot, reflecting all the solar energy going to waste, they could essentially be plugged into grids in the parking lots.
You're exactly right. And this is a technology that's perfectly suited for that type of application. Once they scale up manufacturing and bring down the costs, you will see these dish engines used in a distributed capacity.
Okay, now speaking of using solar-generated power for transportation, what can you say about the advantages or timetables for running vehicles off of electricity or using the electricity to generate hydrogen and put it into fuel cells or to burn the hydrogen? What's the picture on that?
In the hydrogen front, we're still probably a solid 20 years away.
Okay, so we really shouldn't consider that a near-term option.
It's not, let me put it this way, I wouldn't keep my car,
right,
my garage running for another 20 years waiting for my,
right,
next car to be a fuel cell vehicle.
Okay.
But I would look at hybrids and plug-in hybrids,
right,
as the next option. The first being, you know, the Toyota Prius or the,
right,
Ford Escape and some of the others that are actually on the marketplace. What I'd like to see is those vehicles actually generating a greater fuel economy rather than greater power output for the same fuel economy.
Right.
And that's what you see in the Prius and some of the others. Those are just your standard hybrid vehicle. They are now producing, they're now developing plug-in hybrids.
Right. Now, there's sort of some entrepreneurs here in Southern California. I've interviewed one of them who are doing these plug-in hybrids,
mm-hmm,
which is sort of bringing back the EV1 plus the Prius hybrid engine.
That's exactly right.
So that you can, and if you're just running around town and run 40 miles a day and you're getting your power from electricity, you're not really burning any fossil fuels.
That's exactly right. And that's the type of driving that uses the most type of fossil fuel.
Right.
And it's the idling and it's the turning the car on and off,
right,
the greatest emissions because the engine isn't right.
What can you say as someone who's been involved in this, is this a tipping point that these contracts with SCE and SDG&E to really bring down the cost of these units, to make it more feasible to use them in a distributed sense, to make it worthwhile for the car manufacturers to make plug-in hybrids, to really start moving the U.S. off of a dependence on foreign non-renewable energy and make it get its energy from domestic renewable sources?
I think we'll all look back on 2005 and look at it as a pretty special year. I wouldn't call it the year of solar,
right,
but I would say that it's the beginning of the new solar revolution. Well, this is the first, in the energy bill, we had the first residential tax credits for solar in 20 years.
Right.
And if this Congress enacted tax incentives for solar, you can see what kind of dire energy consequences we're in. And so I think that kind of recognition within the Republican Congress and the Republican White House is a sure sign that not only is the technology mature and it's tried and true, but that it plays an important role in our energy mix. And if we have the same conversation in 5 years, I think we'll see any forecast that we would make today thrown out the window. I think we'll see a lot more solar installed, and in 10 years from now, solar will be the lowest cost option at the retail level for consumers.
Okay, that's pretty promising. Say something about the fact that these big installations are done at market rates. There are no subsidies involved here, as far as I can see. But you've said that it's also a good sign that the Congress has voted for residential tax incentives. What's the interaction between the building of these large plants without subsidies for the market for subsidized distributed energy production?
Well, again, I think they serve two different purposes. Distributed really addresses energy security. It addresses peak power demand at the retail level, which, again, is most expensive. So I think it's important for, areas like New York City and New Jersey and, California with a million solar roofs bill,
right,
and other places to look at distributed generation, both solar water heating and PV, as an important part of the energy mix. With respect to concentrating solar power, it provides firm peak power, and so this really becomes kind of base load. It becomes the power plant and the support of the grid network. And I would say that we would all like to get to a point where we do not need any subsidies or rebates from the federal government, and we stand on the technology alone.
Okay, so in fact,
what we're headed in that direction. The reality is, as an industry, we really haven't received much government support. So, the strides that we've made and the fact that SES is there already is pretty spectacular. And I think as you continue to see the cost of fossil fuels increase and the cost of solar come down, the lines at which they cross and solar becomes the lowest cost option becomes sooner and sooner. So what the federal government has decided to do is to invest in solar, both at the residential level, and they increase the commercial tax credit. So there is now a 30% tax credit for commercial installations of solar for all technologies.
Okay.
And, so it's great to see SES standing alone without it, but there's still many technologies that are not quite there yet, and I applaud the federal government for taking that leadership role.
And again, you're saying that the construction of big plants using concentration and distributed sites using photovoltaics and water heating are very complementary as a national energy policy.
Absolutely. The beautiful thing, all three of these technologies displace natural gas.
Right.
Concentrating solar power displaces the need for natural gas peaking units.
Right.
Photovoltaics displace the gas for natural gas peaking units. And solar water heating displaces natural gas for the use in heating your hot water or heating your home.
And doing all of this reduces the need to build liquefied natural gas plants that could blow up in the port cities where they're located.
That's exactly right, or make us even more dependent upon foreign sources of energy and unstable governments.
Okay, let me talk about two things more. The picture I'm looking at here of the Sterling Energy Systems installation, it's at Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico. What's been the role of Sandia National Laboratories and the federal research establishment in general in pushing this forward? How important has that been?
R&D is extremely important to the solar industry, and Sandia really has had a spectacular program for concentrating solar power over the years. Part of the problem, unfortunately, is that Congress has gutted most of the R&D programs, and our budgets have come down consistently for the last 10 years or so.
Are these commercial installations now going to possibly change the tenor of the discussion in Congress so that there'll be more money for R&D as well as more money for residential and commercial subsidies?
That's certainly what we're lobbying for.
Okay.
And the feedback we're receiving is that people are willing to invest in those technologies that are viable, and as opposed to those that are often the future. And
so essentially,
meaning not viable.
In other words, it was proof of concept that took place at Sandia, and now there's going to be proof of installation, essentially.
Absolutely.
And that's going to be a powerful argument, you're saying, for moving the agenda forward.
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about your organization and its agenda and what its function is and what its role there is in Washington.
Sure. The organization, again, is called the Solar Energy Industries Association, or SEIA. We're the National Trade Association for the solar industry. We represent all four technologies. One we didn't talk about was solar hybrid lighting.
Right.
And we are the basically the Washington lobby for the solar industry. So
right.
We are the face and voice in Washington and at many of the states for the solar industry, ensuring that we remove market barriers, we expand markets, we increase R&D, and we educate the public on the benefits of solar energy. We have a website, www.seia.org. Great source of information for solar, for information on tax credits, for information on what's going on at the state level. I encourage everybody to take a look at it, and when in Washington, give us a call.
I'd love to
bring you up and meet your congressman.
You want to give a brief synopsis of what your legislative agenda is right now, how people might want to get involved with you in pushing it?
Absolutely. Well, we just passed the tax credits, which were a huge victory for the solar industry. Again, there it's a 30% residential tax credit, 30% commercial tax credit, and but the part of the problem was they were only offered to the solar industry for 2 years, which is kind of a tease.
It keeps people from making capital investments to meet the needs there if they don't know it's going to be there for a long time.
That's exactly right. So our first priority is to go back and get those extended. The Senate had originally asked for 6 years. We want to go back and get those years back.
Who are the champions of solar energy in the Congress?
We have a number of them. Perhaps our biggest one in this last legislative cycle on the energy bill was Senator Lamar Alexander from Tennessee. But we also had
not the one with the checked shirt who used to run for president.
Checked shirt, former governor, ran for president.
Secretary of Education, too, for a while, I think.
Same man. That's exactly right. And we worked closely with Senator Alexander starting about a year ago because he was asking a lot of questions about natural gas. What can we do to bring down the price of natural gas?
Right.
So we went into him. We showed, hey, solar is the perfect technology for reducing natural gas. Now, we can't displace all of it immediately. But we can, in the short run, make some very significant contributions. And so we became part of his Natural Gas Price Reduction Act of 2005, chunks of which came out and ended up in the Senate Energy Bill, chunks of which we were able to preserve in the final conference. So he's been spectacular. Senator Bingaman, Senator Domenici have been strong.
Senator
leaders.
Bingaman having been an astronaut and a mechanical engineer as well, right?
Senator Bingaman is actually an attorney.
Oh, I'm sorry.
From New Mexico, Boxer and Feinstein have been great. Senator Reed from Nevada has been.
So it's a lot of the southwestern senators.
Southwestern, a lot of northeastern Republicans. Senator Crapo from Idaho. Senator Smith from Oregon. What we've really tried to do in the last year was spread our breadth of supporters, so it wasn't just senators from the Southwest. But we really had those who could benefit from an expansion in the manufacturing of solar.
Presumably, the Sterling engines. I think when I talked to Mr. Light, he says they're being built in Detroit by people and machines that used to build cars.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the steel is going to come out of Arizona, and they're going to be a lot of different parts coming from throughout the United States. So I think what we're trying to show is that the next great technology. Industry, the next great high growth industry is going to be the solar industry.
So if they were making The Graduate again, Benjamin Braddock was standing by there by the pool and the neighbor was telling him what he should get involved in, he wouldn't say plastics, he'd say solar. Huh?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Today that's exactly the case.
All right. What do you think could be done to increase the likelihood that in the presidential election in 2008, these issues that we've been talking about and that are obvious to us as important for national security and the economy and the environment, how can these be put higher on the list of things that are debated by the candidates so that no candidate who doesn't have a strong, innovative, thoroughgoing program on solar could be considered a serious candidate for the presidency in 2008?
Well, I think energy issues are one that are going to be a significant economic driver. This winter, people will face the largest heating bills that they've ever had. This year, we're facing the largest transportation costs that we've ever had. And we all recognize that those aren't going down in the foreseeable future. So in the next election, the percentage of your income that goes to providing energy in your life is going to be much greater than it has been at any other point in time, at least in recent memory.
And you're saying that ought to help concentrate people, to use the phrase from the physical process here, to concentrate their attention.
We'll be feeling a lot of economic pain because of it. Industry will be feeling and is and will be feeling a lot of economic pain, and we won't have any solutions to either our transportation, our heating, or many of our electricity concerns. Again, okay. Not to quote the EIA too much, but they estimate electricity demand to increase by 25% by 2020. So that's a huge increase in demand at a time where the price is also going up. So we'll be continuing to feel the pain, and I think that alone will be forcing many of the questions to be answered by the candidates.
Okay, now before we wrap up, I want to expand the discussion to include the whole rest of the world, because, for example, one way into this discussion is the fact that gasoline prices are rising in the United States in part because of demand in China and India, where there's more demand for oil now because they're presumably going to move along the same developmental curve that the Europe and the United States and other countries have. Now, what's the possibility for intervention in that historical progression, if you can call it that, by establishing Stirling engine installations and other solar energy generating technologies in the developing world, the rapidly developing world of India and China in particular, so that they can skip the stage of burning fossil fuel and move directly to a stage of using plug-in hybrids for transportation and other applications that would remove even more demand from the world picture of natural gas and other fossil fuels?
It's a great question, and I can talk about it from solar in general as opposed to Stirling in specific.
Okay, sure.
But you still have well over half of the world's population without electricity, and so you have an opportunity.
So it's sort of like New Orleans now in half of the world all the time.
That's exactly right. It's an opportunity to, as you build, consider how you build.
Right.
You know, I live on a street in D.C. that's got, you know, all sorts of power lines and telephone lines and cable lines going through it. It's the god-awful ugliest thing you've ever seen.
Right.
And yet you look at every new development, and they're not running the lines at least above ground. They're running them below ground.
Well, right.
Do you even need those lines is the question.
Right.
So I think, because they're so darn expensive to run, I think what you're going to see is the answer is no. You can live with distributed generation just as well.
So in the same way that there's going to be a million solar roofs in California, you could have 100 million solar roofs in China.
That's I think that's exactly right, and I think that's the direction they're going. China has a renewable portfolio standard that's very aggressive for a country that's growing that fast and that is going to be that large, as does Korea and India. So I think what you're going to see is those markets in particular will grow very, very fast and will, in many respects, drive the rest of the global market. But, where we are today and where we're going to be, 10 years from now, it's difficult to say, except for the fact that we all now recognize that a fossil fuel-dominated energy portfolio is not sustainable, is not inexpensive to sustain, and is not desirable.
And it doesn't help political stability very much either.
Not unless you're sitting on, not unless you're in Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's the epitome of the instability.
Right.
Say a little bit about the value of either really distributed photovoltaics or distributed but concentrator systems like the Stirling engine for even less developed countries than the ones we've been talking about, particularly in Africa. I just saw the Constant Gardener. There was a lot of beautiful scenery in places that were seemed to have a lot of sun and not much in the way of economic development. What's the possibility of putting these installations in areas in Africa that don't really have a grid yet, use this to generate electricity, and then use the technologies we haven't been talking about at all, telecommunications, wireless telecommunications systems, to bring education, democracy, culture, and commercial development to areas that are where people subsist on less than a dollar a day now?
It's your only choice in Africa. And the reason why is you don't have the money to build billion-dollar grid systems to move electricity around. You don't have the infrastructure in the sense of the engineers and the construction to be able to put those systems in place. You don't have the fossil fuel resources other than, kind of the western coast near Nigeria to support it. So,
right.
The reality is those are the kinds of systems you see going in right now. Those are the kinds of systems you'll see going in the future. And as Africa and remote parts of Asia continue to expand and grow and their need for electricity starts coming into place, you are going to see a much greater use of solar, both concentrating as well as PV.
And an issue we haven't talked about, which I think is still continuing, is the migration of people from small villages into large cities. If you put one of these Stirling engines or photovoltaic systems in a village and you use satellite or WiMAX to connect the people in the village to the grid, they can essentially be move into the into 2005 while remaining in an area that's more environmentally sustainable instead of having all of them move into the city. Is that a possibility as well?
Absolutely. I think when you look at what the World Bank is doing in certain cases, UNEP and others, they're looking to do just that, maintain the rural infrastructure and agrarian society, agrarian communities in these countries. And the best way to do that is to bring technology into those communities. And that means a reliable source of electricity, which comes from your only choice there is solar, unless you want to truck in the diesel, and then providing them with the technical connection to the rest of the world.
To go totally over the deep end, might it not even be possible using this, what we've just talked about, for sustaining human habitation in a decentralized village way, to even start emptying out the cities into the hinterland and building more towns and cyber villages that would use the decentralized power of solar, the telecommunications wireless grid, and allow the dismantling of the huge urban conglomerations that are inherently ecologically unstable and unsupportable?
Well, Mark, I'll tell you, it's not that much of a stretch from urban sprawl that we have today, where people don't want to be in the city, so they're moving farther and farther away from the city,
right,
and can still be connected,
right,
with maintaining the rural infrastructure that exists in many of these other countries.
I mean, obviously, really rich people move out to places that are like that, and they have their satellite dishes and stay in touch and do their financial work and whatever out there in the middle of nowhere. Is this also a step in the way of moving more people into that kind of lifestyle?
Hard to say. I think there will always be major cities. There are different types of people who love the urban environment.
Right.
There are people who love the rural environment. And
but this could move to more balance, more options, more flexibility.
This gives you more options, absolutely.
Okay. I want to thank you again for talking to us here on Utopia Media Solar World, and I hope we can talk more and use a higher percentage of renewable electricity in our conversations and the distribution of it in the future.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thanks very much. Don't hang up, but let me say goodbye and okay. Thank you. Okay. Bye.